Rewinding. Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind.
FM. Kaya FM 95.9.
Home of the Afropolitan.
The Law Report with Michael Matwening Bell, Kaya FM 95.9.
A very good evening and welcome to the Law Report. What are we talking about this evening? We're talking about the Road Accident Fund. Do you have any claim? Were you in an accident? Are you still waiting for your claim to be paid out? This is the show to call. I'll be joined by two expert lawyers that's going to be taking us through some of the processes, helping me answer some of your questions. As always, number to dial 086-000-0959.
Know your rights, know the law. The Law Report with Michael Matwening Bell.
Good evening, this is the Law Report. We do this every single Wednesday where we talk about different issues of law and, of course, issues that are relevant to you. And as always, we want to engage with you. We want to make the show about you. We want to deal with your problems and your concerns. So if you have any questions where you have had an encounter on the road and you've had an accident and you want to know how you can go about getting help, or you have somebody that you know that has tried this and that method and is still having been helped some years later, do give us a call. Number to dial 086-000-0959. You can also send me any of your questions by using my Twitter handle. It's Matwening Bill, at Matwening Bill. That's my Twitter handle. And I look forward to engaging with you and dealing with your questions, because I can very well understand if you have a situation where you've been in an accident, you know, the laws around this have changed over the recent years. What can you actually claim for? What is claim worthy, right? And when you do claim, you know, what can you expect in terms of compensation? I mean, we watch TV episode or programs like I Blew It and somebody gets $2 million. And yet you might know somebody that got much less than that. How do you work out how much one gets in what circumstance or what scenario? So that's what we're doing tonight. And I did say, do call. I want to welcome my guests, joined by two lawyers. The first lawyer is Lerato Tobakhali from Mabunda Incorporated. Lerato, good evening, and thank you so much for joining me.
Good evening, Michael, and thank you for having me tonight.
And also, I'm joined by Kirsty Haslam, a partner at DSC Attorneys. Kirsty, good evening, and thank you for joining me. Hello, Kirsty.
Hi, I'm here.
Good. Are you well?
Not well, and yourself?
Very good, thanks. I mean, it's often when we talk about, you know, RAF, it's often, you know, taken for granted that people know when and how one gets paid, and sadly, you know, I'll be sitting in you know, with family or friends, and an old man will come and tell me how they got an accident some years ago, and you ask them, did you claim? And they sort of tell you that they didn't know that they could claim. So one does take for granted the fact that not everybody knows how this works, and one does take for granted that, you know, when, even if you know, even if you think you know how it works, there are intricacies, there are processes that are underway. You know, there's also sort of, it's never straightforward for many reasons, including, you know, opportunism that also manifests itself in this process of claiming from the RAF. Maybe let's just talk, if I may start with you, Lerato, around what it is, you know, in what, one, how does RAF work? When can I claim and when can I not claim?
Okay, so I think the most important thing to note is that anybody that has been involved in an accident can claim.
Mm.
But it is restricted by people, for instance, if you were not, you cannot claim from the RAF if you did not sustain any injury.
Right.
You cannot claim if you were the sole cause. So if you were the person that caused the accident, you were driving. Either you were driving and you were the sole cause of the accident, there is no other motor vehicle that is involved. Or maybe you're a pedestrian or a cyclist, but negligence solely lies on you. So the accident happened because of you.
Mm.
So if you are the cause of the accident in a nutshell. So if you caused the accident, then you cannot claim compensation from the Road Accident Fund. So, but if you were injured on any part of the South African road, in an accident, then you may claim. You may institute a claim.
And I want to remember to talk about this, because often lawyers that work with RAF would also work with other types of intellectual claims, I suppose, like train accidents, etc. So when we talk about accidents in the context of this show tonight, what kind of accidents are we talking about? Which ones are included and which ones are excluded? Because there's sort of various groups of accidents, and the example that I provided is one for trains, where
it has to be a motor vehicle accident. So it has to be a vehicle. Or it could, a vehicle would mean your cyclist, and it would mean your motorcyclist as well. So it has to be, a motor vehicle must be involved on a South African road. So it cannot be any other thing. So as long as, I think it has four wheels, to simplify it, as long as it has four wheels and it's operating on a South African road.
Or if it's a motorcycle as well. Yeah. Okay, Kirsty. It sounds all good and well, where the proposition is, well, if it's your fault, you can't claim. But I can imagine a scenario where, you know, Michael is a breadwinner, and my children, if I die, may not want to know whether it was my fault or somebody else's fault, or whether it was I was the sole cause of it, or whether I was alone. The fact of the matter is, they would be left without any financial support and future financial support, assuming I have young kids who still have some 18 years, for example, of maintenance requirement. It sounds a little bit arbitrary to me, in a way, that because I was alone, I don't get paid. But if there was somebody else, I don't know. Take me through that process, because I mean, I can understand if I'm claiming for myself as Michael and I'm there to answer whether it was my fault or not. But my children, on the other hand, may not be able to maybe unduly prejudiced, I suppose. Your thoughts?
Well, that's an important example that you mentioned, Michael, because in loss of support plans, which is what you are referencing there, if there are two vehicles involved, then the dependent.
Listen, Kirsty, I want you to answer that. I'm just gonna park you for 2 seconds, and then we're gonna try to get you on a better line, because what you have to say is very important, and we don't wanna compromise the quality of our conversation owing to a weak connection. So we're gonna try again. If you've just joined us, I'm talking about road accident and the Road Accident Fund and your right to claim. In what circumstances can you claim? When can you not claim? You know, and we're also going to be talking about a number of things, but I don't want this to be about me and what I have to ask. I want it to be about you. So you got to call in, and you got to do so by using the number 086-000-959, where you ask your questions. Kirsty, let's give that another shot.
I'm sorry about that, but going back to what you were saying, so when it's a loss of support claim, such as you were talking about, if there were two vehicles involved, the dependents only have to prove a nominal 1% negligence on the part of the other participant in that collision.
Right.
So, because there, no fault can be attributed to the dependents, obviously. And there's very few accidents that happen between two vehicles where there isn't contributory fault on both parties.
But I mean, I was gonna even put this proposition. There's hardly an accident. I mean, I want you to finish that trail of thought. But my other concern is, I just to jump in, if you will allow me. My other concern is that there isn't an accident where somebody isn't at fault. And it seems therefore that if we see an entire accident, it almost means that only half of the people in that accident are going to be paid.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. Look, if you are the wrongdoer and there's a joint wrongdoer who is the driver, then you will be compensated proportionate to your relative degrees of negligence. And isn't that fair? You know, if you're both equally at fault, then you're both equally compensated to that degree of fault.
Mm.
But where it comes to dependent claims, which is what you were talking about earlier, obviously the dependents weren't at fault for what happened. So there is notional...
I'm sorry, Kirsty, the line is bad. Maybe we're going to hang up, and maybe as we do, maybe try to move around or you know, but let's just try to get you on a better quality phone. Lerato, you got the question that I'd put to Kirsty. Perhaps you can sort of help us deal with this issue. And I think we was talking about the issue of loss of support that might be brought by dependents.
I think, unfortunately, as much as we can put on the table that the dependents are not at fault, or it is not their fault, so that the breadwinner of the family has passed on, we look at the element of negligence will solely lie with the person that has died. So it's under very rare circumstances. Like Kirsty said, you know, you have to prove 1%. You know, some people may say that there was a disruption on the road. This person may have been swerving to avoid a pothole, or this person may have been blinded by an oncoming car, and maybe there's a statement attesting to that.
Mm.
But where you find that there is nothing that would prove that there was a cause for that person to be involved in an accident, even though there was no other vehicle contact, then unfortunately we are not, well, the law looks at it as the wrongdoer cannot be compensated.
Okay. Now let's talk about, you know, we talked about loss of support almost as if everybody should understand what that means. Maybe unpack for us what kind of claims or what kind of damages one can claim from the RAF. I mean, you know, who the different groups, and if we're talking about loss of support, who can claim it? What sort of are the prerequisites for launching such a claim?
Okay, you can claim for loss of support where you have a breadwinner that has died and you are a dependent. Now, dependent we have to establish whether there was an actual duty to support. So I cannot deem, for instance, let's say a brother of mine dies and I'm living in that house with that brother of mine. You know, it becomes very difficult to prove loss of support if you are not a dependent of the deceased.
Mm.
So it has to be either the children of the deceased or the wife of the deceased.
Mm.
You know, but the law has evolved over the years. You know, you could be living with somebody for 10 years and that person becomes your life partner. So the definition of a dependent has expanded, but we have seen with instances like parents, your aunts, your uncles, so your extended family is normally excluded from the definition of a dependent. So any person that has suffered a loss that is a direct dependent of a deceased can claim for loss of support. But you know, as much as we love to support our family, our extended families, when it comes to issues of loss of support, it is very rare that the law, again, there will always be exceptions when we take the matter to the courts and a full trial is run, but it is very rare on the face of it. We have not complied, basically, if you are not a direct dependent of the deceased.
So Kirsty, I put the question. So we know that you can claim for loss of support, and I think Lerato Tabakgale has explained very nicely who can claim a loss of support. But what other species of claims that one can bring other than loss of support?
Well, if you have been injured yourself, so absent the loss of support claim, so this is you claiming in your personal capacity. First of all, you can claim for your medical hospital expenses to get better, both in the past as well as those which might follow.
Mm.
So prospective losses in the future. You might need a knee replacement in 20 years, for example. That can be claimed. If you've lost income, both in the past as well as in the future, you might now face the prospect of early retirement or reduced earnings in the sense of you can't work a full day anymore and so forth. And then finally, there's general damages, which is compensation for pain and suffering and loss of amenities of life. So that's a compensation for the trauma, inconvenience and all of those kind of factors that, that you have experienced as a result of being involved in that accident.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking to Kirsty Haslam, a partner at DSC Attorneys, as well as Lerato Tabakhale from Mabunda Incorporated. And we're talking about RAF. How can you claim? What is the process? How long does it take? Any question that you might have, give us a call, 086-000-959. So the complaint that one often hears is you know, how to go about claiming. And I know that there's been some movements where the RAF is trying to discourage, and I could be misrepresenting the RAF, but discourage the use of lawyers where, you know, claimants or prospective claimants are encouraged to apply for the RAF directly themselves. Let's just talk about maybe the process and maybe take into account, you know, the current way or the traditional way or the competing way of using lawyers and the other one of claiming directly. And what are some of the things to consider when one is bringing a claim? Any one of you ladies can just take that. Whoever jumps in first.
Okay. Well, if I... Oh,
it's a draw.
Let's get in there. I
think what is important for people to understand is that the avenue of lawyers, you know, we are normally named the Road Accident Fund discourages the use of lawyers because of the cost issue, obviously. Mm. We are trying to curb the amount of money that is paid out and also, you know, the curbing of fraudulent claims and so forth. But what people need to understand is that the use of the lawyer, well, not to be subjective in this instance because it's my job, but you need to understand that our job is to make sure that a person is adequately compensated for the injuries that they suffered and what may come after that. So when you come and you approach me and you tell me that you want to institute a claim against the Road Accident Fund, the first thing that you need to understand that it's not going to be an overnight process.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to just me submitting papers. Yes, there's the process of lodgement, which is me now submitting. This is me making the RAF aware that there is a person that intends or that is seeking compensation for injury.
Mm.
Now, the law allows us to submit such documents and allow the RAF 120 days for them to investigate the claim, for them to satisfy themselves that there is an actual claim, there is no element of fraud and so forth. And that's when the litigation process starts. So should we not receive an offer on behalf of the client or should we not receive any form of communication from the Road Accident Fund, then we go on to the summons stage. So that is when litigation begins. And, you know, unfortunately, there's always a back and forth of an exchange of legal papers, which most of the time we explain to clients to try and break it down. But the most important thing is that using an attorney allows you to also get your injuries assessed. So you get taken to your different experts that are going to determine for us if there is a legitimate claim in terms of your injuries, whether your injuries are serious or are they not, and the consequences of those injuries. So how does it impact you going forth on your life, on your employment, and up until a stage where we call it retirement. So Kirsty, I think, touched on it. It would be your general damages, which speaks to your injuries and the trauma that you suffered. Mm-hmm. And then it would be your past and your future loss of earnings, which is the injury. How has it impacted you? You know, some people, it's a direct loss of earnings, and some people, it's a loss of capacity. You know, that person would not advance as they would had they not been injured. And people need to be aware that that is something else that they can claim. You know, if you cannot work as you did before, we cannot overlook that. So that those are the... I think the technicalities that a layperson wouldn't know they can claim from the Road Accident Fund. So I would think that is the advantage of using attorneys.
I'm taking your calls, 086-000-959. I'm going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking some more about road accidents and the Road Accident Fund, how you can claim, how much you can get, etc., etc. We're back after this.
Bringing you a diversity of views and African stories. This is Kaya FM 95.9, home of the Afropolitan.
Welcome back. We're talking RAF. We're talking about what happens when you are in a road accident. Can you claim? How can you claim? What's the process? What are the pros and cons of, you know, using a lawyer versus not using a lawyer? And I think that question has been answered. If you've just tuned in, do give us a call. This is a show for you. I want to deal with your questions. Like Katleho, you can call me on 086-000-959. Katleho, good evening.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm good, thank you. Mm-hmm. I just have a question for Lerato. Is it Lerato?
Sure. Shoot.
Sure. So, Lerato, I heard you mention that if a deceased has dependents, the dependents can claim for RAF. So, I have a scenario, not a scenario, but a my a parent situation. Passed away in a situation. My parent passed away in an accident, and I am for a biological child. So I'm 28 years old. Can I claim for RAF? Because I've heard stories that if you're over the age of 18, you cannot claim. So I want to know if there is an age criteria or how does it work?
Very good question, Katleho. I anticipate that Lerato may have some questions for you, so stay on the line.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. The first thing that we need to find out is, yes, it's true. The criteria for loss of support, you cannot claim loss of support if your parents died when you were over the age of 18. So that is the age where we say you are dependent on your parents according to the law. And also, for instance, let's say she was under 18, we also need to look at the issue of prescription. So we need to look at whether the claim is still valid. I think that's another issue that people need to be aware of, is that there is what we call prescription. It's sort of like an expiry of a claim.
Yeah.
So where you have identified drivers, where you know who the driver was that you were involved in an accident with, or you know where registration, or you know an owner, where we can basically establish who the person that was driving at the moment, at that moment of the accident. You have 3 years in which to lodge a claim with the Road Accident Fund. But where a driver is unknown, or whether you have a hit and run, you have 2 years from the date of accident in which to claim for any form of compensation. So that is the one leg. So you need to look at prescription in this instance, and then you also need to look at the age of the dependent. So if the dependent is over 18, indeed, you cannot approach the Road Accident Fund for a claim.
An interesting one from me, and just piggybacking off Katleho's question, because I know in the law of maintenance, now I'm just a little bit outside, you know, RAF and its rules, the criteria is not only limited to age, it's also in need of support. So if I have a child who's 30 that I support, and maybe I support because either they're still in school or they have a disability or something like that, but factually they need my support as in maintenance law, as in in family law. They can successfully bring a claim, and I think the easiest one for a 28-year-old is perhaps some physical condition that renders them unable to earn their own income and therefore rely on the parent for support. Would age in any way be a factor then in those circumstances? Then maybe another example. I mean, 18 is just, I know when I finished matric, I wasn't 18, I was 19. And even then, I still needed to go to university, which took me longer than most kids. Sorry, self-indulgence there. I apologize. So, but the point of the matter is I needed maintenance up to age 25, 26. Yeah.
So if I can jump in there, Michael, please. Because I think Lerato has summed it up all perfectly accurately, but I've personally, in practice, succeeded in establishing support claims to the age of 21 or even 23. Because it depends on, as you correctly say, your particular circumstances. So yes, 18 is the general benchmark, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible to claim beyond that, because you might be in tertiary studies, you might be in abject poverty, you might be in a circumstance where you remain reliant on your parents to support you. And, you know, in law, your parents have a duty to support you until you are reasonably supposed to be self-sufficient. So there's definitely the prospect of proving a loss of support claim beyond the age of 18.
Right, so it's not, so in answer to Katlego's question, I guess, it would be whether there are any special circumstances in her situation that would warrant her getting, not getting, because it's one thing to get, but being entitled to maintenance from her parents even. It's not because I'm not getting a job and therefore I need maintenance, but it's, there has to be something like, for this reason I can't do it myself. Is that sort of more or less the answer?
Yes, it very much depends on the facts of the circumstances. And as you point out, there could be a disabled child, for example, that would be dependent for a longer time. So, you know, it's a good benchmark, the 18 years, but there is capacity to look beyond that.
Interesting. Now, you touched on this a little bit, Lerato, where you're talking about life partners. And it's obviously a very difficult one, because for the RAF, it then becomes, I mean, if somebody's married, they just pop up a marriage certificate, but even then, there's other hurdles where you actually have to prove that the person, because we could be married, but it doesn't flow or follow that you're entitled to maintenance by virtue of marriage. Now I'm just trying to think about how the courts deal with this thing where people are living with one another, and somebody then says, but this person used to be my person, and they are now deceased, and now they don't bring the entire paycheck to me anymore.
I think the important thing there, Michael, to establish is that there was a reciprocal pattern of support and duty of support. You know, there's a lot of people that choose not to get married these days for good and bad reasons, but you know, that doesn't change the fact that they were in a mutually supportive financial relationship. You know, if we think of there used to be categories of marriage that were prejudiced against in the past, such as Muslim marriages, for example.
Yes, there and Hindu.
Civil partnerships, there was a range of those. And it's taken the passage of time for those to be expressly recognized by the court in the context of RAF compensation. So, you know, as long as you couldn't move in with someone possibly for a month and then claim loss of support, that would be, you know, that would be not reasonable. But, you know, where you have an established domestic partner relationship, there's certainly scope to prove that reciprocal duty of support that you had towards one another.
Let me ask this question, and I think it would be top of many people's minds. I mean, maintenance or support means different things for different people. So somebody who is losing on an income of $5,500 a month would be different from somebody who is losing loss of support of 200,000 rands a month. And I know there was a bit of a debate, which I think is worth discussing around, you know, what can I claim if I was earning 5,000 rands a month versus somebody who was earning 200,000 rands a month? Are there differences in what each of those people can claim?
Well, you have to prove actual loss.
Yeah.
You know, you have to prove that actual loss of support. So, yes, those are two sort of very distant examples that you suggest there. But in terms of the regulations and the amendments that came into effect in 2008, there's actually a cap on the annual losses that you can suffer by way of either your own loss of income or your loss of support. So the 200,000 rand person would you know be impacted by that cap on an annual basis.
Mm.
So the 5,500 rand person would not be impacted by that cap, and they would probably be fully compensated.
And do we know what that cap is? Because
well, it started in 2008 at 160,000 rand per annum, and this is calculated by actuaries as to what the present day value is, etc. And that cap has been adjusted quarterly for inflation since 2008. So it currently stands at, if memory serves me correctly, it's about 270,000 rand annual loss. Is the current cap.
And I mean that sounds. I get the rationale, but it also sounds a little bit unhelpful to many people, because 250,000 rands per annum would mean nothing to you if you used to have an income of 3 million.
Yes, that's correct. But you know, these measures were introduced as cost saving measures by the legislature, and they saw it fit to introduce these caps. And unfortunately, we have to live with it, because something else that is part and parcel of the RAF legislation is that the common law right to claim directly against the wrongdoer is removed. So you cannot, if you've suffered the 3 million rand loss, for example, you cannot say, okay, I'm going to take what I can take from the fund, and I'm going to go against that millionaire guy in the BMW that struck me, and I'm going to go for him against him for the balance.
Yeah.
You can't do that by virtue of the RAF legislation. That driver is indemnified against those claims.
But I mean, yeah. it does two things then. I mean, let's talk about, it does two things, because what it means is that when I'm a top earner, I should prefer to be injured in any other situation other than a motor vehicle accident. In other words, I should rather prefer to be hurt in have a building collapse on me, because then there wouldn't be a cap there, as opposed to me being in a motor vehicle accident. Is that sort of the result?
Well, I think we'd all prefer not to be injured in any circumstances, if I can put it that way.
It's a choice of a poison.
But let's look at this statistically. Statistically, you're far less likely to be injured by a building falling on you, as opposed to our horrendous fatality and injury rates on our roads. And it's an embarrassment, actually, to our country that we rank in one of the worst rates of road accidents that happen worldwide.
Yeah.
This is a real, you talk about pandemics, you know, we've got the COVID pandemic. The other pandemic that's been with us for many, many years is our accident rate on our roads.
I think it's an indictment on a lot. We indicted in a lot of fronts. I mean, GBV, we're right up there with gender-based violence, rape. It's,
you know, we score higher.
We win on the bad things.
Yes, exactly. We're in all the wrong places.
Yeah. All right. So I got a text message here, and it's unfortunately unsigned. It says, if I am unlicensed driver and get injured in a motor vehicle accident, that is not my fault. May I claim from RAF?
You certainly can. Mm. Because, you know, unlicensing is a regulatory infringement.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean, you know, you can be an unlicensed driver sitting stationary in your vehicle at a stop street, and some maniac who is drunk comes and drives
with a license.
with a license. So what does that mean? So regulatory infringements have nothing to do with establishing fault. So,
right.
So ours is a negligence. You have to prove negligence, and whether you do or not have a license, that might be a factor, but it's not determinative of your right to claim.
Lerato, let's talk about something that you alluded to a little bit, where mm-hmm. you said that the process is you know, the claiming process is somewhat a protracted one. What, when we talk about that, what sort of is the expected range? I walk into your office and I say, I have this claim, what should I be looking at in terms of turnaround time?
On a good instance where, you know, we don't experience any hiccups or anything like that, one could expect between 2 years, because remember when you assess, I think that is another thing that should be brought forward, is that a pre-requirement for any claim for general damages is that the claimant needs to be assessed. We call it an assessment report. So it has to be assessed by an expert. For instance, if you have broken bones, you go to your orthopedic surgeon if it was a head injury. So that expert has to make the determination whether the injury was serious or not. And now for us to take that into consideration, whether you qualify for general damages or not. Also, there's what we call the NMI. So it's the maximum time in which it's the maximum medical improvement. That's what it stands for. So normally experts think that 2 years is the adequate time for a person for them to make it conclusive finding, you know, that this person would either deteriorate or would improve in their injuries. So we need to be careful not to take them on too early. For instance, if I take you, you've got a fracture now, and I take you to an expert in 6 months, the finding may change from the 6 months. So your prognosis, so to speak, is not the same in the 6 months as it would be in the 2 years. So that is another thing that people need to understand. So most of the time, it goes a little over 2 years if all things go well, because we also need to understand that our judicial system has been under pressure. Yes, we have, you know, your practice directors which are trying to curb and unclog the court rules for us to take matters to court. But I would say, honestly, Michael, I would say on a good claim where we don't have any hiccups, you know, a straightforward claim, I would recommend that a period of 2 years, just so that we are careful not to undercompensate and overcompensate a claimant.
And something that I thought about as you were speaking, you remember, Kirsty, Lerato was talking about, you know, the advantages of going via a lawyer and the many experts that you know, Lerato was alluding to. When you go directly to the RAF, who pays for all of these experts? Who, you know, because these experts are not, it's not when you're actually getting paid. It's, these are just people that give reports on the extent of your extent of your injuries.
Well, unfortunately, the Road Accident Fund can insist that you instruct your own expert. You know, they have their own expert, but they're paid by the fund. And, you know, the man on the street would have a reasonable apprehension that perhaps that expert would be best served by saying what the Road Accident Fund wants it to hear.
Yeah.
And if you want your own expert, then they will invite you to find your own expert. And the important thing is, in the context of, as Lerato has correctly said, you have to go and find someone to complete a serious injury assessment report. That expert, even if you've had the Chris Barnard of heart surgeons, for example, if he isn't certified by the AMA, so the American Medical Association, to apply the specific test that has been mandated in the regulations, he cannot complete it. So you need to find yourself an AMA certified specialist who is prepared to provide and complete that serious injury assessment report. So, you know, realistically speaking, you're not going to get that as the man on the street unless you go to a competent attorney who has those resources and contacts and panels of specialists who are able to provide that service.
I want to take a break, and when we come back, I'll be taking your calls on any issue that's related to road accidents, any injuries that you sustain whilst driving, whilst cycling, whilst walking. And the number to dial in order to get an answer from any of my guests is 086-00-00959. I'm back after this.
The Law Report. with Michael Matswening Bell, Kaya FM
95.9. Welcome back. I'm continuing my discussion talking about road accidents. And I've just, during the break, my producer has a question. I'm like, you call in and ask it. I'd ask it yourself. I'm not going to ask it on your behalf. Spa?
Yes.
Shoot.
So, what happened last year? Evening, guys. Evening, Christy and Lirato.
Hi. Hi. How are you?
Oh, cool. I'm finding yourself. So, what happened was I was a passenger in a motorcycle. And we were involved in an accident last year. I didn't get as much as, I would say, big injuries or severe injuries. It was just a minor thing, but I'm not an expert, so I wouldn't know what minor is. But I stayed off work for a couple of hours, for a couple of days, and I just want to find out, how long can someone claim? Because this thing happened last year, December, and I haven't went to the road accident fund or anything, but I did suffer a broken rib and minor scratches.
And he's really okay. Pretty, so scratch means a lot more to him.
So you mentioned an issue for general damages, just
being
an issue.
Exactly.
I'm assuming that you're over the age of 18.
Yes.
So that would mean that as from your date of accident, you have 3 years to submit a claim, lodge the claim with the Road Accident Fund, which Lerato explained beautifully earlier. Mm-hmm. And once you have lodged a claim, you actually have 5 years from the date of accident to issue a summons if your claim is not satisfied. So you've definitely got plenty of time to submit a claim.
Okay, perfect.
There's something he dealt with in very quickly, which is a minor injury, and he explained that it was a broken rib. And you are 100% now?
Yes. Today I'm 100%. I could come to work and everything, but I couldn't come to work for a week or two.
Right.
Yeah.
So does that at all? Because, I mean, when we talk about you have to have been injured, what kind of injuries are contemplated by the regulations?
Well, he wouldn't qualify for an award of general damages for pain and suffering because that would fall below the threshold of what, they introduced a threshold test for general damages, which is that it must be a serious injury, and there's all sorts of prescripts as to how you qualify as a serious injury. So on the sounds of it, it would not be a serious injury. So general damages for pain and suffering would not be there. But if you have a provable loss of income or a provable loss in the sense of medical and treatment expenses, then that you could certainly recover.
Okay, thank you. Because that was my next question. I was about to ask, can I factor in the medical expenses that I'm going to the doctor, getting the medication and all of those?
Yes, definitely. That is definitely recoverable.
Okay. Something that sprung to my mind is the issue. You know, more and more we are being sensitized to non-physical injuries, right? So when you talk about mental illness, it's becoming more topical, and we're becoming more and more aware of it. And I'm trying to think whether that at all would feature where, you know, the trauma that I sustain, perhaps it's exacerbated by my own personal history or my own disposition. Are we moving in a direction where somebody says, look, I mean, I don't have any physical injuries, but I was in an accident where 17 people died and I was the only survivor, and I'm really now having to see a psychologist, psychiatrist, or a combination of those? Are we moving in a direction where those are in any way covered?
That is such an important issue. That is so important. And again, it highlights one of the, I think, a tragic amendment that came in 2008. Mm. So where you are directly involved in exactly that scenario that you explained, if you're a direct victim of the accident, then certainly mental disorder and injury arising from that is certainly a recoverable aspect of your loss. Mm. But there are also tragic instances where you are what is described as a secondary victim. So you're the mom at home and you get that horrible phone call and your child, your loved one has died. And you go through not only a bereavement process, but you are psychiatrically injured. Now, those secondary victims were expressly excluded as from 2008. Mm. And in fact, that's the only instance where the right to sue the wrongdoer remains alive. So if you are a secondary victim who has suffered demonstrable psychiatric injury, you can still sue the wrongdoer. But certainly, if you were the one involved in the collision, it doesn't matter if you haven't had physical injury. If you have psychiatric injury from that incident, then you could still claim compensation.
Sure. And have we had any kind of success? I mean, I don't practice in the personal injury space, so I don't have a sharp, I don't keep a sharp eye on these issues, but have we had sort of successful claims? I'm not talking about the secondary damages, just one where somebody says, look, as a result of being in the accident, I haven't been able to work, my concentration span is not what it used to be, therefore my productivity levels have diminished. Every time I hear a sound, I used to work, for example, in this environment, and every time I hear a bang, that bang, brings about these memories, and I go into this episode, which then requires me to undergo, I could go on and on in terms of, have these sort of issues been tested as one would expect, the question of mental wellness becoming more and more topical. Have they featured in the RAF space?
Definitely. I've represented any number of claimants that have had, on the face of it, not significant physical injury, and yet it has had a profound impact on their psychological well-being. And, regrettably, people are just, if you see a broken bone, you're more sympathetic.
Yeah.
And mental illness is, it's not visible.
Yeah.
So there's a high index of suspicion around those injuries, unfortunately. So you have to work harder to prove that. But you certainly can, and I've had cases, I'm sure Lerato has had cases, that have involved those kind of instances.
So the RAF is bound to be bankrupt then, if there's such a wide scope.
A wide scope, yeah.
I think a comment there, Michael, that, the problem, the RAF is a perfectly imperfect system in the sense that, you pay according to how often you use the road, because it's when you put in petrol and you're paying the fuel levy. If you're more on the road, you're a higher risk. So, your degree of contribution is proportionate. The main problem, which is never effectively addressed, unfortunately, is that we have a horrendously high accident rate. That is our problem. If we could address the accident rate, the system is completely affordable.
Yeah, which I'm sure the minister would like to hear from you and the solutions, because it seems almost an impossible one. I mean, when you think about road carnage, it's not, you can't address road carnage in and of itself, because that's not where the issue is. The issue is in corruption. The fact that I know I can drive intoxicated, but the chances are, very good that when I'm caught, I can pay my way out of that situation. That really is, I think what hurts every aspect of our civility or our civil life is the fact that you can just pay your way out of it. And sometimes you can be as drunk as, I don't know what the analogy is, and with $100 pay your way out of it. If it's that cheap to pay your way out of it, then we it's very difficult for me. I mean, I don't want to say it's hopeless, but it's very difficult for me to see any kind of hope when we have an underlying problem that features everywhere. When a woman reports a crime and says, I'm being beaten up, but the man comes and pays his way out of that, and in every other situation, it's so easy in our country, sadly.
Well, corruption, unfortunately, is a systemic problem at the moment, and it's not peculiar to only the context of road accidents and drunk driving, etc. And you correctly point out that you've got to start at the root of the problem in order to have any hope of improving things.
Mm. All right. So when we talk about claims, I mean, how do we work out? I mean, Spa just spoke about a broken rib, and somebody else might have varying degrees. How do you get to a point where you can say, ah, this one, 1 million for I'm talking about.
Well, it takes a lot of hard work. It takes
exactly.
Can I get the non-lawyer answer? So what's the non-lawyer answer?
Look, there's no non-lawyer answer. It varies from injury to injury. You know, we cannot just look at the injury on its own. Mm-hmm. But with the compensation, we are guided by the quantum yearbook. You know, we don't just thumb suck figures to say, oh, this one deserves 100,000 and this one deserves. So we have legislation that guides us as to how do we compensate for injuries sustained.
So let me ask. Let me tell you why I asked the question. Because if I'm not mistaken, it's not something that I certainly remember from my lawyer life. But I remember my dad; he was a fetal interner, and the machine clipped his two fingers. And when he explained to me, they had sort of a formula that says, well, if you get injured at work and you lose this finger and that finger, this is generally how much it is. If you lose a hand, it's this much. If you lose up to the elbow, I'm not sure if there was any sort of truth to what they explained to me when I was still young. Is there a similar thing where, I mean, I think Kirsty referenced the American Medical Association. Is there sort of like, you know, guideline to say, well, if your injuries are like this, then, you know, this is generally what your damages would be?
You know, okay. What you're talking about there, Michael, is a workman's compensation claim.
Yeah,
and then you're in a very different sphere than with road accident claims or any other form of personal injury claim, for that matter. So if you're injured on duty and it's purely an injury on duty, then you are governed solely by workman's compensation.
Yeah.
And yes, then it sounds very impersonal, and it is, because one finger is worth X and another finger is worth Y, and, you know, that's unfortunately what it is. But, you know, if you're injured in any other context, if you're a piano player and you lose two fingers, you know, you're a piano player for a living, then that's a very different, context. So, unfortunately, your father was injured on duty and got limited compensation. And also, workman's comp doesn't pay general damages for pain and suffering. It's purely on loss of income or your reduced disability factor that comes into it.
I guess even that is not a perfect science, because, I mean, you reference an example of a piano, somebody who plays the piano, and I was thinking of a certain DJ who does fine. with just one hand. Anyway, so
your call has been placed on hold.
You're closing.
Please wait.
So I'm not sure who that is. Lerato, are you still there?
I'm sorry.
Okay. So, I can hear you fine. I was just checking whose line is placing us on hold. I mean, your closing remarks. You know, what kind of advice would you give to somebody who's claiming or is in an accident? So what are some of the things to look out for, just as a closing remark before we close off?
Okay, I think for every listener out there, you know, with every field, there's an expert. You know, there is a person that is out here dedicated to help people with a specific problem.
Yeah.
So as much as there is a disparagement of the usage of consulting competent attorneys,
yeah,
I would urge people, because there are certain spheres of your pain that you wouldn't understand. For instance, I think Christy touched on the emotional part of it, you know, the trauma part of it, and you'd find that it expands and affects other areas of your life which are claimable. But if you do not know, if you don't have an attorney that is going to adequately advise you, people should not be scared to seek the advice. Go and find out so that you understand the time frame, you understand the requirements that you need to meet, and you understand the processes. So we are here to help you, you know. And we are by no means discouraging that people go claim for themselves.
Yeah.
But I just think for a listener at home who's a layperson and does not understand what is required versus an attorney that has been in practice for a certain period of years, I would urge people to rather seek adequate legal advice before exploring either path.
For sure.
You know, it does not stop you from still saying, okay, I'll go claim myself, but rather be equipped to do that than sit at home where you can get the help that you need.
Kirsty, yours in just under a minute, we have to wrap up. Your closing remarks.
Well, I'd start with what sounds like a flippant comment, but, you know, if your appendix was about to burst, would you take it out yourself? No, you wouldn't. You'd go to a surgeon who is skilled to do it. And, you know, it's no different in this field.
Yeah.
There is a plethora of statutory regulations and hurdles to overcome. And, you know, never forget that you're fighting a monolithic structure. It's a massive government structure, the fund. And you know, it's David versus Goliath. So you definitely need someone with weapons on your side.
Well, ladies, thank you very much. That's Kirsty Haslam, partner at DSC Attorneys, as well as Lerato Tabakhali from Mabunda Incorporated. Thank you very much. And to you, the Afropolitan, thank you very much for being with me this evening. I trust that you've enjoyed that show. I'm back again next Wednesday, where we'll be covering yet another topic of law. From me, Michael Mutoning Bill, good night.
That was the Law Report with Michael Mutoining Bill.
Kaya FM 95.9.
Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind.